Hello and welcome to the Turtle Tracks podcast. This is your host, Brian Van Hooker, and I'm here today with a senior editor from IDW Comics, Bobby Kernow. How you doing, Bobby?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Oh, thanks for doing this. So, for those who don't know, IDW Comics has had the Turtles comics since 2013, 14?
That sounds about right. We're working on issue 80 right now, so that's 7 years. So I guess it's earlier. I guess it's about 2011, probably.
Oh, that's right. It predates the Nicktoon. I forget that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. And it was the trade over in 2009. So, as of recently, the IDW Ninja Turtles line is the longest running Ninja Turtles comic book ever. How was that landmark? So that was with issue number 73, if I'm not mistaken. How was that landmark taken over there?
It was, it's weird. It's one of those things where, you know, we've been working on the comic month to month for like I said, for several years. And so, you know, you don't really get many opportunities to kind of stop and take stock of something like that. But this was an opportunity where we were able to, and being there with Kevin Eastman, working on the book, I think we all realize it was something kind of special.
Yeah, and saying this as a fan, like I'm somebody who's like always been a fan of the Turtles, so when this book came out, I was like aware of it and like was excited about it. So it is really something special. It's a fantastic comic book.
Awesome, thank you very much.
So I'm curious, how did it come about? Like when I know Nickelodeon acquired the rights in like 2009. When did Nickelodeon approach IDW or vice versa? How did this comic come to be?
You know, I can't speak too much to the very, very, very early beginnings. I just started at IDW in 2010. So by the time that we were talking about getting the license, I was an assistant editor. So being a lowly assistant editor, we're not too much involved in the deal making, for lack of a better phrase. But you know, I knew that Nickelodeon was searching for a comic books partner, and so different publishers were pitching. You know, we sent a couple different things to them, but what I think really resonated was Tom Waltz, who is another editor at the company and is the scriptwriter on the series. He put together a proposal that I think really resonated with them, had a nice mix of old and new, and that's kind of how it got started. And we talked for a long time about different creators being involved, and we all kind of thought Kevin Eastman was done with Turtles, because he sold his stake in the Turtles before Peter Laird. But you know, we talked to him, and, you know, I guess he had enough time away, and he was eager to come back to the property. So we brought him on board, and then everything just kind of snowballed from there, and we were on our way.
So I'm curious, how's the story process begin? Did it begin with Tom Waltz and Kevin wades in, or how does it all kind of come together now?
It's evolved over the years. At the beginning, it was when we were really just trying to get everything out pretty quickly. It was Tom would write up a proposal and then work on the script, and Kevin and I would give notes along the way. And it's kind of evolved over time where the three of us will have what we call our mind meld sessions. Well, we'll sit around, we'll talk about where the book's been, where we'd like the book to go. And based on that, those meetings, I'm the one who now draws up a kind of a paragraph by paragraph outline of the issue that usually, you know, says, okay, the first five pages will be our introductory scene where Casey Jones is fighting Hun or the Purple Dragons, whatever's happening in the issue. And then Tom will take that and write the full script, the traditional full script from that. And sometimes Kevin will give notes on the script, but really Kevin is involved in the very early in-person brainstorming sessions. And, you know, he's reading the books as they come out too, and we'll give notes from here to there. So it's a nice collaborative process that with Tom kind of doing the the lion's share of the work in writing the actual script.
Now, for the overall arcs and everything, I mean, I know that you guys were very open about the fact that you planned, like, a very distinct arc from episode from issue 1 to issue 50. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's accurate.
So, like, was there any sort of, was that dreamed up all by Tom and Kevin and all you guys together, or was it, like, a singular vision that Tom had from the start?
No, I'd say, you know, I'd say the first 12 issues are largely all Tom, with Kevin and I making some small notes here and there, but, once we were able to kind of get our feet under us, we were able to, and by that point, we knew the book was successful, and we knew we could start thinking about as far as issue 50. So usually what we do is we had a very loose idea of how we wanted up to number 50 to go. We knew that we wanted Shredder to die in number 50. Spoilers, sorry.
No, we're going to talk plenty about issue 50 anyway, so yeah, there's going to be plenty of spoilers from issue 50.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's fair game.
Yeah.
Shredder dies, Splinter taking over the Foot Clan. We wanted them to be a big battle. And there's a bunch of things we wanted to hit along the way. There's characters we wanted to introduce. We wanted to introduce Bebop and Rocksteady, Rat King, a lot of the main characters, Fugitoid, a lot of the main characters that you see in the first few years of the book. Obviously, Casey Jones and April. We wanted to kind of set up all the major characters. And have it the main overarching theme be Shredder as the main antagonist, along with Krang and the Technodrome. So those were our main goals, is to kind of deal with those two villains and reach that status quo at the end. But how we got there, we look more in depth. We always have the next year pretty well planned out. In detail, but beyond that, we'll have a general idea of stories we want to hit, characters we want to hit. But sometimes if it's more than a year out, sometimes details will shift as the story develops. Just maybe something we planned for issue 85 works better in 90. That's just kind of things we find out as we go along. So there's always the big roadmap, and then we've got kind of the immediate destination and much more focus and detail.
So, you know, now that we're on the topic of issue number 50, I mean, like, for those who haven't read it, it is, like, it rivals any Turtle story ever. It's a fantastic story, like, and it's the perfect, like, build-up of confrontation that, like, it took a long time to get there, but it never felt like it was forced to get there, which was an amazing story to tell years in the making. It was great.
Yeah, thank you. That's we really have a luxury in that we knew that the property was stable and was going to be able to go for a few years at least, and now we're well past that. But that's a huge luxury that you often don't have in comic books, and so we were able to seed ideas and characters that that would germinate over several years, and I think that's. Not to toot our own horn, but I do think number 50 was very effective, and we're all proud of that book, and I think it's a good culmination of those first 4 years. But we're lucky in that we're working with a property like Ninja Turtles that is well known, has a strong fan base. We're lucky that we're able to use Kevin Eastman on it. So we're really lucky in a lot of ways, and I think that luck shows in the end product of number 50.
Oh, it totally does. I mean, I was impressed by a number of things. I mean, the fact that you guys had a Shredder with a some semblance of honor was, I don't think, something we've seen before.
Yeah, that's something that was really important to us. We always want to make sure villains aren't just, and especially with someone like Krang or Shredder, it'd be very easy to default them into sort of stereotypical mustache twirling villains, but the fact that we are doing a monthly comic book and that these characters do have history, so we're able to build on that history. It's not like this is the first time we're introducing these characters, so I think because of that, there's some things we can kind of do in shorthand, and then we can quickly move past that shorthand of the characters' motivations or desires, and get into new territory, new ground. And I think it all made sense to us that Rokusaki, who had this long history in feudal Japan with Hamato Yoshi, Splinter, it all made sense to us that he's not pure evil. He does have some semblance of human in him. So that to us felt right, and it felt satisfying. It was a way to have him give closure to that villain with some modicum of dignity, I think.
Yeah, it was completely different, because you would expect Shredder to be, I mean, you'd expect him to be a little bit more one-dimensional, and he has a semblance of honor, especially when he goes out, which was amazing. And
yeah, well, I think, just to talk about AIM, what I was saying about building what came in the past, you know, number 50, that ending scene, we very much had the original Mirage Turtles number 1 in mind, where they defeat Shredder, and, you know, they hand him a sword to say, okay, you know, please end yourself with dignity and commit, seppuku, the ritual suicide. And so in the original, Shredder takes out like a bomb and is like, no, you guys, F you, and, throws the bomb at him. So we didn't want to hit that exact same beat again because it's been done. So we had him presented with the same opportunity and basically took the other track. So that's a good example of, That was a really good story decision, but had we not had the alternative already presented before us, maybe we would have done the same thing. You know, it's hard to say. So Kevin always said about the people that came before him that the artists that inspired him and Peter, artists like Jack Kirby and Frank Miller, Kevin would always say, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, and that applies doubly to Tom and I and the artists on the series.
Well, yeah, I think it's, I mean, for people who aren't fans of the original Mirage comics, I mean, that's probably the most jarring thing, is to find out Shredder's dead in issue 1.
Right, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But no, talking about, like you know, how you chose the alternate path for Shredder, like, is there conscious decisions to not step on the toes too much of any other Turtles property, or is it like, I mean, how are those decisions made?
Say there's some sort of formula that, you know, we say, okay, this was done then, this was done now, that equals this result. Really, we just feel it out in those mind melding sessions. We talk it out. We say, you know, what would be exciting. So I think we're definitely looking to do new things. We're using a lot of old characters, and we use, right now we're in the Invasion of the Triceraton storyline, and that's a storyline that's been done several times in different Turtles mythology. So, and usually it's just the Triceratons, you know, they're coming in and invading, and they're bad guys. And in our story currently, where they've come to Earth trying to look for sanctuary, and they're perceived as enemies, when really they're coming in peace. So it's a kind of a combination of what feels right and doing what feels new in the context of what's old. So I think we'll often take something that's familiar. So a reader who's familiar with Turtles will say, okay, it's this storyline. I'm excited. I love Rat King, or I love Baxter Stockman, so I'm excited about the storyline. But then we try and do something new with that. I just mentioned Baxter Stockman, and Every convention we go to, someone says, "Hey, when is Baxter Stockman gonna turn into a fly?" And I readily say now, as I say then, it's never gonna happen. It's what's expected, and it's just not something we're interested in doing in our book. As long as we have something that is we think is more interesting to explore, so hopefully that keeps the book interesting and different. So. I think audiences always really like when they are expecting something and then it's tweaked or changed and something new comes. So that's our general approach, is to do what feels right to us and tweak what came before us.
Now, is there any stories that you've kind of purposefully avoided or put off on doing because it was too familiar?
I don't. I, I would say say there's things we put off because it just didn't feel right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things that are examples of that are we didn't introduce Bebop and Rocksteady. We kind of hinted at them, but we didn't formally introduce them until issue 25. And I think a lot of people expected us to do it a lot sooner than that. Same thing goes for Leatherhead, who debuted post 50.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of it is we want to kind of space out those major villains so we could get that new, you know, the new excitement around them every few months or years. And then part of it was just, you know, it didn't really feel right. It just didn't feel right to include them earlier than that. So, you know, by this point, we've hit most of the major TMNT characters of lore. But it was important to us. But, you know, that's we're 7 years into the run of the book. It was important to us for not to just bring out a character just to bring out the character because they're a fan favorite. We wanted to make sure we had an idea that we were both excited about, and that was new and different, and most importantly, fit for the story.
I gotta say, now that you bring up Bebop and Rocksteady, I mean, I've been a fan of Turtles forever. They're like, I was born in 85, so there's not really a time I remember pre-Turtles. But your guys' take on Bebop and Rocksteady made me like kind of re-fall in love with those characters in like a whole new way, to the point where I'm like, even more, like, even when I'll rewatch the old cartoon or anything like that, there's something about your take on those characters that's maybe my favorite thing you've ever done, is making them fun and so much like their originals, yet still incredibly threatening.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's, I think we're proud of our take on that too, and that's something fun to do, is to take old silly characters and make them, and still keep them at the core of who they are, but make them relevant. In the case of Bebop and Rocksteady, make them dangerous. And you know, and for us, it just made sense. You know, what's you've got a mutated rhinoceros and warthog who are extremely powerful, don't know their own strength, but they're still dim bulb, so to speak. So, and that makes them more dangerous because they don't know what they're capable of completely, and they're also just, you know, kind of sadistic dudes. And I really have to give a shout out to you know, I think we've done a great job with them in the ongoing, but my favorite interpretation of Bebop and Rocksteady are the different issues done by Dustin Weaver and Ben Bates. They did the first micro series with them, and then a couple years ago did our mini series Bebop and Rocksteady Destroy Everything.
Mm-hmm.
I just love their take on those characters, because not only do they present them as what we just described, dangerous and stupid and funny, but they also find a heart to them. They're the ones that really kind of home in on the fact that these guys are outcasts, but together they're brothers. They're not outcasts to each other. And there's this love and respect between them and this great friendship. So, you know, they're terrible characters. You don't want to root for them, but part of you kind of does. And that's when you know you got something good, when a villain or a hero has those shades of gray that make the character deeper and also more relatable.
I mean, it continues a great tradition, because I mean, like, the Nickelodeon cartoon, which just recently ended, one of their final episodes had their Bebop and Rocksteady swan song, and it was done beautifully. And the original Archie comics had those two kind of opt out of the whole evil villain thing, and just kind of not want to be bothered with it at all.
Yeah, go to that planet where they can just chill and be themselves. Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my favorite aspects about that series too.
Yeah, it was a cool like take, and you guys have continued where it's like really like they have that, like, I don't know if heart's the right word, but like, yeah, there is a companionship, and they're fun. Like, I mean, your book is there's more comedic interpretations of the Turtles, and there's heavier interpretations of the Turtles, and I think your book is on the heavier end of that, but you guys have had some great opportunities for fun stuff, and I'm thinking specifically of Bebop and Rocksteady Destroy Everything and Dimension X, like, some things that are, like, are lighter, but don't disrupt the continuity of the book either.
Yeah, I think that really is another thing that speaks hugely to the popularity of the property, is that you can do everything in it. It can be funny, it can be deathly serious, it can be absurd. You know, it can be melodramatic, and all that is sort of in the title. You've got, you know, ninjas, but you've got mutants. Mutants are weird. You've got teenagers, so you got some melodrama. You know, it's just a weird property that, that covers set. You can do space stories, you can do street stories. It's just it's an incredibly flexible property, and that's why I think it's fun to read. But just speaking personally, it doesn't get boring, just because, you know, say we have a big you know, brawl on the streets, you know, nitty gritty gang war type thing, and then we can follow that with something that's completely opposite out in Dimension X, and there's weird aliens. So it's always kind of refreshes itself, and that's always a lot of fun to work on.
Was there any acknowledgement? So I thought when I saw Out of the Shadows, which is, you know, take it or leave it as a movie, but I love their Bebop and Rocksteady, but I loved it because I thought, like, this is the IDW Bebop and Rocksteady. I mean, did you guys kind of feel the same thing when you saw the movie?
Yeah, it's hard to tell, because I think there's also elements of that in the 2012 show too. And so it's one of those things. Is it just in the zeitgeist? Because as far as I know, I don't think the cartoon and certainly into a bigger extent the movie, because that was the show was done by Nickelodeon, but the movies was really controlled out of house per se. I also want to disclaimer that I don't know what I'm talking about here. I know about the comics. You know, the movie was really done by on its own. So in terms of different similarities between the characters, I don't know if there's any. I'd be surprised if anyone was reading our comics that worked on the movie. But maybe. So I think it's just one of those things where it makes sense. You know, you want characters like Bebop and Rocksteady to be stupid and funny, but you also want them to be an actual challenge for the turtles. So I think it all just kind of makes common sense.
True enough. Now, next I'm going to turn to what I think is the most, and you have a lot of great original characters, there's Kitsune and a handful of others, the Pantheon, but to me, the most dynamic, interesting, original character for your book is Old Hob.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk at all about him, but I mean, like, I'm really impressed by what you guys have done with that character.
Yeah. You know, there's sometimes just characters that just kind of come out of the ether and work. Old Hob, I think originally, back, we talked about when we were talking about getting the license, we talked about just having a new character, a new mutant that would, again, kind of set the series apart. So we didn't want to lead off issue one with Shredder. And it was editor-in-chief Chris Ryle at our company, who I think just came up with the idea of, what about some mean alley cat as an enemy? And then Tom just took that and ran. He was just very much just a kind of a stooge villain at the start. You know, he had his little gang, he was mad at the turtles. But he's someone who, and we never were like, okay, let's change track and make Hob cool, let's make him, multifaceted. He's a character that really just kind of naturally evolved from issue to issue, from year to year. And I wish I could say it was something that was really, premeditated and planned, and that we have this whole character arc for Hob, but he's a character that just kind of never went away. He always seemed to fit in whatever, in the stories he's in. And then gradually, gradually looked at him, and we looked at what we had established, that he hates humans, that he's kind of got a inferiority complex, that he wants to have his own family, that he never had for himself, that he kind of wants to create his own family. So kind of by year two, by the time those building blocks were set up, we kind of thought, okay, he could be an interesting leader for the Mutanimals, who, the group that we were creating into the Mutanimals, which is, they're not completely good guys like the turtles, but they're definitely not bad guys. So they're kind of uneasy allies, and after year two, we sort of more concretely started planning his story arcs. But at the beginning, he was just a bad guy and with nothing really beyond that. We thought he looked cool with an eye patch, and that was about it. So no secret story there, but just one of those rare characters that works, and you follow him as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, he's come about. It does seem very natural the way he's come about, and like, Mutanimals book is another example of like getting that lighter mood and more fun, but also their mission is incredibly like important, especially to Hobbs, like to old Hob. Like, it's just a, I don't know, it's that whole arc they've done with Mutanimals has been really interesting, and it's so different from other takes in the Mutanimals where it's just like, all right, well, we just want another mutant team.
Right.
And now it's like, this one's really interesting.
Yeah, no, well, thank you. That's that was on purpose and something we're trying to do. If anyone's reading or listening and wondering, you know, wait, where are Hob and Mutanimals? Because they've been a little absent recently. You'll get a nice tease of them on the last page of issue 80, which is the last issue of the invasion of the Triceratons arc. That'll kind of give you a hint as to where they're going as characters.
Do you guys get a lot of clamoring for a Mutanimals series?
We do. We do on occasion. We do get letters about that in Ninja Notes. You know, the Mutanimals miniseries that we did sold fine, but it wasn't gangbusters, so it wasn't something obvious that we should do as a continuing story arc. But hey, I hope it shows that we love those characters, and that's why we keep them around and want to see more of them.
No, absolutely. Everything you guys have done with them has been great, and Slash has been covered beautifully through the Mutanimals, and like, I'm sometimes a little bit overly nostalgic, so I'm like always like, oh, well, why do they introduce X new character instead of Pandacon? And then I fall in love with the Herman. Like, I just like, there's great characters that I like. I not only don't want to like them, but I'm just like, oh, well, there could have been filled by X nostalgia character, and then you have great new characters come about through that.
Cool, yeah. And, you know, if there's a character you haven't seen yet that you love, I think it's probably a good hunch that we've discussed them and at least have an idea of where they might be able to be put down the line. But again, we want to, if our Mutanimals was the exact same as the Archie Mutanimals, I think, you know, you wouldn't have that novelty, you wouldn't have those new characters to explore, and you wouldn't have those new dynamics. So it's something that, at the end of the day, we kind of just write for us first, and if we're entertained by what we're doing, and we're feeling like what it works, we hope that translates into the wider world. But it's a lot more fun for us to have a mix of old and new.
Yeah, I mean, and you guys did a really interesting take on Dreadmon recently. Like, just really good stuff. Like, that you don't see coming. Like, I didn't expect to see Dreadmon maybe ever, because it's just such an obscure character. But I was really happy with that. Now, going, you know, I'm going to go back quickly to the beginning. So, for the people who don't actively read the comic, the Turtles in this version, there's a reincarnation story, which is a completely new take on the Turtles. They died in the sons of Hamato Yoshi back hundreds of years ago, and Shredder killed them off, and they were reincarnated in the modern day. How did that story come about?
That I think is what really set Tom's original proposal, what really made it work for Nickelodeon and everyone. You know, there's lots of things that about the book that I think we could say is a group effort, but that aspect of it, that just came 100% from Tom. You know, it was his idea, and that's something that that, you know, we knew it was going to be a curveball, and we could see that, you know, this might anger a lot of fans. And so, you know, we weren't sure about it, but we wanted to go for it just because it opened a lot of story potential in terms of the history that Splinter and Shredder have with each other, explaining, you know, why they're so familiar with ninjutsu. It seemed to open up a lot of narrative possibilities while being different and cool. So if it was just different and cool to be different and cool, hey, maybe we would have done that. But what I got really excited about it is it opened up a lot of story potential for me. And pretty much from that issue number 5 where we talk about, where we introduce the reincarnation aspect, that's, once we were done with that issue, I immediately started thinking about the Secret History of the Foot Clan miniseries, and cause it just seemed like there was a whole world to explore in their past there. So that's the type of thing that it's, when you get excited about the story potential of something and it seems kind of new, those are the type of things that we try and embrace and really run with.
Yeah, I mean, did you guys face any backlash from that, from like hardcore fans?
Not really. Not as much as we expected. I think there's a couple people here and there who say, "Ah, that doesn't make any sense," or you know, I loved the original. You know, even though it's kind of campy or pulpy. You know, we should have kept it just like the original, where you know it's Splinter the Rat kind of just mimicking and learning from his human master. His human owner, but you know, not too much. I mean, there's a couple comments we got at the very beginning, but not really since then. You know, occasionally I'll see someone online who says that our book isn't their cup of tea, and that will be one of several things they'll cite. And you know, I'm totally fine with that. It's no book can be everything to everyone. I love those. The Mirage books are my favorite incarnation. So, you know, I totally understand when people say something like that, or, oh, I wish you kept all of the red masks instead of going to multicolor masks. Those are all things I totally understand and make sense. But it's just, you know, we had to do some things on our own differently, for better or for worse. But it seems in the aspect of the reincarnation, people seem jazzed about it. And like it, so we're all happy that that's the way it turned out.
You know, it's funny, like, you know, it's a series about mutant animals, but, like, one thing that always kind of, like, bugged me about certain, not, I don't say bugged me, but, like, about certain versions was the idea that the rat pre-mutation would have learned ninjutsu and stored it away in his rat brain, whereas I kind of liked certain takes where he was a human first, just because I was like, all right, at least I buy that he was a ninja, you know?
Fine for me, I think, for most people in the context of that first issue, just because it's so out there and crazy. But it's also something that, yeah, you can see, yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Not that reincarnation does or anything, but you know, it was a couple narrative jumps you had to make to fully embrace that if you're looking at it closely, which is something you're going to do when something becomes a big giant property that's beloved by millions. So you know, I think that's, you know, when Kevin and Peter first created it, I know for a fact that they didn't think it was going to go anywhere. They just thought it was going to be kind of a laugh, and they're going to be lucky to make their money back on their initial investment. So I guess I'm kind of rambling. I don't know where I'm going with that. But I think there's some things like that which are just kind of intended for, you know, to be one and done in that first issue. And I'm always curious if they would have done it differently had they known what Turtles is going to evolve into, but that's a question we'll never know, I guess.
True. One of the last things I want to cover with you is Splinter. So much like your Shredder was Shredder with Honor, Splinter is darker than he is in any other version. I mean, for those who haven't caught up, in issue number 50, Splinter takes over the Foot Clan, which was a radical change. He parts ways with his sons. Now, I mean, you can argue that Splinter is a character in this version who, with his sons being executed hundreds of years ago, has seen a lot more than the other Splinters has, but, like, Splinter was much darker in this version.
Yeah, I think that is a result of the reincarnation storyline, the fact that, both he and his family were killed by Shredder. You know, any parent, their foremost goal is to protect their children, and so Matoyoshi really, you know, lived this nightmare, and has somehow come back to life with this knowledge that he failed in that task of protecting his family, his entire family, you know, his wife and his children, and so, you know, it's easier to write Splinter as this loving, you know, sometimes wryly funny character, but it just made sense in the context of our world that all the decisions he makes are influenced by the fact that he saw his children be killed. You know, he was the last one to be killed, and so he saw that happen before him, and that's a gravely traumatic thing that will stay with you for the rest of your second life, as it were. And so, you know, I've occasionally read read story, read comments where it's like, ah, you know, Splinter is really going off the deep end. He's really turning evil. Where in our mind, it's everything he's doing, even though he's pushing his sons away, and that's by design. Both Splinter's design and ours is that, you know, he knows that he can't keep them safe. So he's going to do everything he can to keep them safe, but at the same time, you know, try and keep them away from danger. And right now in the storyline, that means keeping them away from him to a degree. And yeah, I mean, that's just, the first 50 issues were just the Turtles running for their life and trying to find a way to survive with this madman after them and the world, you know, being trying to take over by Krang. Whereas this kind of post 50s, of course, there's many characters that want to kill the Turtles, and there's many characters that, you know, want to enrich themselves. But a lot of what number 51 to 100 is about is, you know, what happens when you have a moment to breathe and take responsibility for yourself. And so that applies both to Splinter and being in a position of authority, and the Turtles kind of being on their own for the first time out from under their father's wing. So and that to us, that's a lot of new stuff, I think, in Turtles, is that Turtles tend to stick under the mentorship of Splinter and kind of, you know, stick to those classic tropes that are introduced in the cartoon. So it's really fun. It's fun and challenging to be in a period in our run where we're kind of past, we've kind of gone past a lot of the charted territory of TMNT, especially now that we're doing things like Dimension X and the Visions, Triceratons. It's fun to even be past those iconic stories now, really going into the unknown. And we've got a couple more iconic storylines we're going to hit, but it's going to continue to more and more become its own thing and be independent of other media, I think.
Well, I mean, it's been an amazing ride so far. I mean, I wanted to ask one other question about leading from darker Splinter. Or at least just compliment you guys on this. I'm a Donnie guy. I've always been a Donnie guy. But your guys' take on Michelangelo following that arc was, like, moving to me. It was fantastic.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, it's a combination of different things. In the first year, we kind of had more of a focus on Raph and how he was separated from his brothers. Then we had a focus in the second year. We had a focus on Leo and becoming Dark Leo. Then we had Donatello. Obviously, you know, he was almost killed by Bebop and Rocksteady. So we kind of try and take these little focuses on the characters, at least for these first 4 years. And then it came to Michelangelo. It's, you know, he actually reminds me a lot of Tom Waltz, the writer. And just that he's so full of heart, and he always sees the good in people and wants what's best for everyone. And so that's kind of naturally at odds with Splinter and the Foot Clan, who, you know, Splinter wants what's best for everyone too, but he kind of sees the being a father and coming from a different time period, he kind of sees the world in a different way. He sees it as a much more dangerous world where you can't give people a second chance, and you can't be trusting. So it's been interesting to explore Michelangelo in that way and put him at odds with Splinter, but also have him come into his own and not just be the jokester. For him to be really sort of the moral compass of the Turtles, and to be someone who says we can't compromise on these things, otherwise we are villains as well. So, you know, he's the youngest of the Turtles, and he's the silliest of the Turtles. It was really important for us, like we do with all characters, is to not make him one note, to give him a greater depth, and to say, okay, this guy gets it. He understands the world, but he still chooses to live his life with these views. And that's, you know, it's not always easy for someone like Michelangelo or his brothers, but it's something that makes him a hero and makes him someone to look up to.
I mean, yeah, I was impressed by Mikey, and I was very much, like, on his side. I was like, no, screw Splinter, he's gone crazy. Follow Mikey, like, he knows what he's doing.
You know, I read things and I hear things that different other people I've heard, you know, still say, you know, Michelangelo really needs to grow up, and people, you know, I see different opinions on all of our different characters, and that's great. I mean, that means that people are seeing different things in the characters, and that they're multidimensional, so that means... we're doing something right. So, but you know, it's we love Michelangelo here at IDW. So I'm glad to hear you know he's working for you.
Oh, I mean, it's a credit to you guys and the really like the depth and the storytelling that you guys have put into this. I mean, my last question is, who's your favorite turtle?
Good question. I think all of us, you know, it's choosing amongst your children and you know, for me, I'll kind of consider, you know, they're not my children. I kind of consider myself a crazy uncle to the turtles at this point for my involvement. So it's hard to pick, but Leonardo, you know, I'm 36, so like you, I grew up with the turtles. Leonardo was my favorite growing up. I think only just because he had two swords, and that seemed like the coolest weapon combination. But growing up, being an adult now, he still really resonates to me. Maybe it's because I'm an editor, and I'm the one that kind of has to herd the cats and say, okay, this is the direction we're going in. And, you know, meanwhile, everyone else kind of gets to have fun and joke around a little bit. So maybe I just... I sympathize with Leo in that being a difficult spot, but I think there's he's got a tremendous amount of responsibility on his shoulders, and how he deals with that I think is interesting, because he's going to do his best, but he's going to put sometimes too much pressure on himself, and he's still a teenager too. He's still growing up, and so he's going to make mistakes as well. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff for that in there for me.
Well, that about wraps it up. Bobby, I want to say thank you. This has been Turtle Tracks, presented by the guys. A special thanks to the guys over at Turtle Flakes for my partnership with them. Bobby, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for everyone who's